You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 24th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Haley Sweetland Edwards on our piece in the Washington Monthly, The Corporate Free Speech Racket. Fascinating history of the development of the First Amendment as we now know it. Also on the program today, what happens when you appoint a former lobbyist for the telecommunications industry chair of the FCC? Well, he starts to sort of not really change. I'm not really doing anything about net neutrality. Net neutrality, what does that really mean? Also on the program today, Keystone Pipeline decision punted. Good news, bad news? Don't know. Muslims blackmailed essentially with the use of the no-fly list to become essentially spies for the FBI. And announcement from the Department of Justice, clemency rules, which could provide clemency for thousands of federal inmates who have served really excessive prison sentences because of, I think it was crack cocaine. And this is going to come as a shocker to you folks. I know this is going to be hard for people to accept, but just remember that being a right-wing nut job is not just about one person. Cliven Bundy, he believes in freedom, just not so much for the blah people. And a new report shows that the IRS targeted progressive groups more than they did conservative. I don't even read that. I don't know why we're even still talking about this. But
I'm waiting for that news to get to like the right-wing media sphere. So they're like, Benghazi? Forget the IRS story. Benghazi.
Right,
yeah.
Benghazi. Now, of course, we know that the reason why we could argue that Cliven Bundy is not a racist is because of Benghazi. Folks, speaking of long forgotten, this was some funny sound that took place the other night on the program Jeopardy.
For $1,200.
This pizza magnate and 2012 presidential candidate was a math major at historically black Morehouse College. How quickly you have forgotten Herman Cain, Julia.
Yes, well, let me tell you folks that here at the Majority Report, we haven't forgotten Herman Cain.
I missed this so much.
Yeah. Gone but not forgotten. Doesn't he have like some type of internet show or something?
Oh, it was it was Cain TV, and it was a failure. So now it just replays the old things, and it's called Best of Cain.
Wait, how long did that exist for?
Like a few months.
Wow, that was a quick turnaround.
Apparently enough to create a whole network based on the best of it.
Right. Oddly enough, there was only the good stuff. All right, well, we only remember the good times here, folks. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Haley Sweetland, Edwards on the corporate free speech racket. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the former editor of the Washington Monthly and now Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, Haley Sweetland Edwards, on her piece that was in the January-February 2014 issue of the Washington Monthly, The Corporate Free Speech Racket. Welcome back to the program, Haley.
Thanks so much for having me.
I really enjoyed this piece. It is a fascinating history into the evolvement, I guess, of the First Amendment. But before we get to that, just tell us about the story involving the National Labor Relations Board that you started your piece off with.
Sure. Yeah. In the summer of 2011, the National Labor Relations Board released a rule requiring all businesses of a certain size to put up a poster in their place of business somewhere where employees would see it, or they could, you know, post it online or email it to employees. If it was physical, it had to be 11 by 17 inches. And I read this whole poster. It's very bland. It says basically that employees have the right not to join a union, and they also have a right to join a union. And it lays out some of the rules on how employees can be coerced, and basically that they can't be coerced to either join or not join a union. As soon as that rule came out, the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and a whole bunch of sort of corporate entities basically freaked out and called this just this huge intrusion on government rights. They said it would weaken the economy and cause immediate irreparable harm for which no adequate remedy at law exists. And they ended up suing in several courts, and I think it hit two appellate courts finally, and was eventually thrown out. And what makes this interesting is that it was thrown out not on some minutia involving the Administrative Procedures Act, but on the grounds that the government, by forcing companies to post a government poster, the government was actually violating companies' First Amendment rights.
Now, let me just clarify something. By thrown out, the case wasn't thrown out, but the NLRB, the NLRB's rule was thrown out.
Yes, exactly. I should have made that clear. Yes, they could not. It's companies are no longer required. There is no rule existing that require companies to post these posters in their places of business anymore.
Now, this is what's stunning about this, of course, is that the poster is obviously so innocuous. It's simply the act of informing your employees essentially what their rights are. Mm-hmm. And I mean, give me your sense, because as we delve into the sort of I would argue the devolution of the First Amendment in some respects, is it your sense that when you say they freaked out, the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, I mean, it seems to me that there's, based upon your reporting here, that there's also an equal chance that they were waiting for something like this, because they are attempting to build essentially a case law.
Of course. Yep. I would say that that's, it's in no way an overstatement to say that there is we're witnessing a sort of devolution of First Amendment law. And the NLRB rule was in some ways just low hanging fruit for these guys. The reason why I spoke to a lot of people at the NLRB, the reason why they wanted to promulgate this rule now, which they haven't done anything like this in the past, a whole bunch of other agencies have. It's, of course, very common to see government posters on, or government fine print on contracts, on credit card statements, on, you know, those little placards when you walk into a bathroom in every restaurant that says employees must wash hands. Those are all things that the government is saying, you know, you as a private business have to do this. In order to protect customers and in order to inform customers of government protections. So the fact that that the NLRB was doing this is not particularly strange, but it does break to some degree with how NLRB has acted in the past. They decided to promulgate this rule now because I think we're down to 7% union membership in this country. I might be wrong on that exact percentage, but it's something around 10%. It's just very, very small. And so NLRB thought that, you know, people should be aware of what it means to be in a union. There's no longer this culture of union membership. And anything involving organized labor these days is, as I said, sort of low hanging fruit. These business roundtable and chamber probably saw this and thought, oh, well, great. We can jump on this, get this thrown out and add to a whole bunch of other case law that is coming up and we can talk about, that they're beginning to get rules thrown out left and right based on these First Amendment rules. First Amendment ruling.
So let's go into this. And you wrote this actually prior to the Hobby Lobby decision, which was also sort of based on the notion of a corporation having First Amendment rights. In the case of Hobby Lobby, it was of religious expression. So walk us through this. I mean, where are we now in terms of, and then we'll talk about how we got there, but where are we now in terms of the case law regarding the free speech rights of corporations? I mean, it's obviously, you write about how expansive it's become, and the idea that you could say it infringes upon my free speech as a corporation to have a government poster required to inform workers of their rights, that's pretty expansive.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's, so to answer your question as simply as possible, is there, where we are with defining corporate free speech rights is very much under attack. It's very much evolving right now. We have not reached a point in which it's clear where corporate free speech rights begin and where they end. And in this piece, I get into a lot of the history of that. Basically, there's two types of corporate speech. One is economic speech. It's advertising, it's marketing. And that can be, and the Supreme Court has been pretty clear that the government can regulate that. to a lower standard of, and it's subject to a lower standard of scrutiny, to use that the kind of term that the court uses, that it's okay to regulate commercial speech. And then there's a different kind of speech, which is political speech. And when corporations speak politically, when they're donating to a campaign, when they're, anything that is political, that is not subject to this lower standard of scrutiny. That has to be, that gets the same exact respect in the court of law as, you or me, going out on the street and standing on our soapbox and talking about our personal convictions and beliefs.
All right. Well, I just want to explicate what we mean when we say lower standard of scrutiny and higher standard of scrutiny. So a lower standard of scrutiny means that there's actually more room for the court to intervene, or I should say, they are more hands off in terms of allowing the government to regulate this.
Yes. Yes. Theoretically, if an agency wants to require a company to label or to, false advertising, there's a good example. So a company can't go out and say, my product cures cancer in their advertising. That's clearly commercial speech. And an agency can step in and say, you can't do that. That's a violation of advertising laws. And for us, telling you can't say that is not a violation of your First Amendment rights. And I use that word theoretically before, because that is precisely what's beginning to change.
Right.
So
I just want to make this really clear, because this is sort of weedy stuff on some level. It's that, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. This is essentially, the corporations are using the First Amendment to slowly encroach upon the government's right, I mean, that we all perceive, I think, to regulate corporations and commerce. I mean, this is the game plan, right? I mean, this is what it's attempting to get to, and it's sort of going through this sort of back door almost.
Exactly. Let me give you a really good example. So the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, has promulgated a rule that says that meat packers need to label their meat, telling consumers where the animal in that meat was born and raised. So, was it born and raised in India? Was it born and raised in China? Was it born and raised in the United States? Consumers have, the USDA says the consumers have a right to know that. The American Meat Institute has challenged that rule and brought it all the way up to the U.S. Court of Appeals in the D.C. Circuit, saying the government, by requiring meat companies to label their meat, saying where their animals came from, is a violation of their First Amendment rights.
Because the theory goes, according to them, the government is compelling us to say something.
Exactly.
It's funny because somebody in my office just said the cojones involved in there, and I think you use that expression or something to that effect in your piece as well, because it is sort of stunning that they're but they are, these corporations are beginning to be met with very sympathetic ears from the judiciary.
Exactly. So another example is in the Dodd-Frank law, the SEC was told to create a law that forces extraction companies like, oil and gas companies, mining companies, Chevron and Exxon basically have to tell consumers about where they are getting where the oil is coming from, where their minerals or oil is coming from. That was also challenged by, I can't remember exactly. I think it was the American Petroleum Institute. The DC Circuit Court of Appeals, saying that the SEC, by forcing those companies to tell consumers where they got their product, that is a violation of their First Amendment rights. They're being compelled against their will to speak. And that's a violation.
And so, I mean, what are the state of these cases, and where is, I mean, where is it heading? Because, I mean, you speak about a future where there will be no corporate transparency whatsoever. And, you know, it seems to me we're not that far off. I mean, if you can't compel someone to say what the ingredients of your product is, we're not that far off from a company saying, like, well, you can't tell me I can't say it doesn't cure cancer.
Exactly. And we're actually seeing those. We're seeing those cases bubble up, those specific sort of false advertising cases bubble up, which is really interesting. In the pharmaceutical world, for instance, it's long been said that that, you know, if you're selling a drug, you can't say that it cures something or it treats something that the FDA hasn't sort of determined that it cures or treats. And in a couple cases, we've seen that crack a little bit in interesting ways. But to answer your question about what the state of this is, again, it's very much under attack. That the conflicts mineral case, the extraction case that I just talked about, that was decided, I believe, you know, last week. It was around April 14th or so. It was that it was thrown out on First Amendment grounds. So that's already determined. That is sort of adding to the case law that supports these corporate claims of First Amendment. And the AMI case, the country of origin labeling case, that will be heard by en banc, which is by every single judge on the DC Court of Appeals in May. So we're watching this sort of unfold right now. If the American Meat Institute wins that battle, that will be a huge crack in what most of us sort of think of as First Amendment, as traditional First Amendment rights.
Now, this was, you know, I don't know that I would have thought that I would have ever pined for the days of William Rehnquist. But just to give us a sense of just how radical, and people should remember, I mean, you know, we talk about the lack of nominations that we've seen under the Obama administration, and hopefully that logjam is will break up now following the nuclear option, and in the event that the Democrats hold the Senate. But William Rehnquist gives us a good sort of notion of just how far we've come in terms of what the conservative perspective is on this. And then we'll get into also how unwittingly liberal jurists have also added to this this devolution of the First Amendment. But talk about when we started to head down this road, and what William Rehnquist had to say about it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting politically, and it sort of shows how far right the right has gone in the last 30 years. But to start from the beginning, a lot of this, this whole idea of commercial free speech is, you know, can be traced back to basically this decision in 1975 called Virginia Pharmacy. And that was the Public Citizen, back when it was controlled by Ralph Nader, went after a law in Virginia that restricted pharmacies from posting the price of their drugs. It was actually painted in their windows. They said that the law said that pharmacies can't do that. And Ralph Nader, you know, obviously very liberal consumer rights activist, said, you know, that is actually not good for consumers. We want consumers to be able to compare prices between pharmacies. And in this decision, in the Supreme Court decided in 1976, a year later, and said, you know what, Nader's right. You shouldn't be able to pass a law that restricts companies' commercial speech unless there's a compelling state interest. And this law at the time was sort of heralded by liberals and consumer rights activists as a victory. And then it quickly from there, I think it was 2 years later in 1978, we see another law. Which was Bilotti, and this is another, you know, kind of the canon of First Amendment law. This is a huge one. And that was based, it was using sort of the precedent from this Virginia pharmacy case. And it said that, that corporations, political speech, so corporations sort of attempting to manipulate the outcome of a referendum in Massachusetts, which is what that case was about, that can't be restricted either. So suddenly you see, and this is where this, it all gets very, very messy very quickly, is in the Virginia pharmacy case, you saw the speech, the commercial speech of corporate entities being protected at a lower standard of scrutiny, again, to use that phrase. And then you have 2 years later, the political speech of corporations being protected at a higher standard of scrutiny. And all of a sudden, this all becomes very, very messy. And over the course of the next, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, you see jurists and lawyers and judges trying to sort it out.
All right. Let me just walk people through this just one more time so that they understand. So in the Virginia case here, the consumer advocates were arguing that this pharmacy should be allowed to advertise its prices. Their argument was sort of like the secondary part of their argument was because it helps consumers. But that part of the argument was basically left outside the court, as it were, in terms of how this carried through. So in the lowered standard of scrutiny, the government, there should be no, the government should not interfere and prohibit this speech. In the next case, that sort of principle was taken to political speech, and sort of the government had to back off like on the affirmative speech that the company was making. I mean, tell me, just walk me through again the distinction there between the lower and higher scrutiny of the commercial speech in the pharmacy case and the political speech in the Bilotti case.
Sure. So this is in the Virginia pharmacy case, it was clearly commercial speech. It was advertising and marketing. And the court decided that unless there was a compelling state interest, you can't pass a law that restricts a company's ability to advertise and market itself. And that was, as you said, decided at the time for consumer was brought to the court on the basis of consumers have a right to know that information. But what it had the side effect of doing is basically allowing corporations, businesses, to be considered speakers under the First Amendment.
And so there had to be a really compelling reason why the government would regulate that commercial speech. And that raised the standard, essentially. Is that it?
Yes, yes. And then in 1978, in this Bilotti case, you saw it was not only commercial speech. It was not only advertising and marketing. It was political speech. In this case, it was the First National Bank of Boston saying that we have a right to speak politically, to donate money to this referendum, to attempt to change the outcome of this referendum. And in that case, the court decided that if a corporation or if a business is speaking politically, so it's not only speaking commercially through advertising and marketing, but it's speaking politically, then in that case, the government cannot restrict that. It cannot restrict it anyway. They have to treat that sort of speech in the exact same way as it would treat you, Sam, standing out in a park and, you know, pronouncing your views on abortion.
So in other words, it's not just a compelling government reason needed to restrict that speech, but it goes beyond compelling, super compelling, if you will. You can't say fire in a theater.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's really, I mean, that's the power of the First Amendment as it's evolved over time, is that it doesn't matter what you're saying or who is saying it. It cannot be restricted by the government.
And this is also the big, this is the big change with corporations too, right? Because we don't, we are suddenly talking about speech as if it is divorced from a human speaking.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Just explain that dynamic.
Okay. So in all of these early cases, and even Citizens United in 2010, the emphasis is always on the speech. It's always on, it doesn't, they, in almost all of these decisions, they don't even mention the speaker. It's always, is this political speech? And it's interesting because it says if the speech, if something is determined speech, then it doesn't matter if it was said by you or me or a Republican or an anarchist. The point is that the speech itself is protected. But as soon as you enter, as soon as corporations, as soon as the speech that is emanating from corporations is also considered speech, then you have to call the corporation, the entity that is emitting the speech, a speaker. And that's when you get into this like very fuzzy territory. There's just so many questions that come up there, that basically the court has sidestepped is the whole, you know, the whole thing, are corporations citizens? You know, I mean, it's almost like playing with the language a little bit.
People have to understand here. The question is does the First Amendment provide rights to people, or does it provide a right to a thing that floats in the air called speech? Because right. If it provides it to people, then we can simply say you as a person have the right to speak and say just about anything short of something that would cause a panic in a theater. If exactly. We provide the right to speech to the product of a human being, then all of a sudden it doesn't matter. You just have to prove that it's speech, that it exists. It doesn't matter that there's no one person saying it, that it's a corporation. I mean, that's basically where the subtle shift happens, right?
Exactly. And that goes back to this 1978 Bilotti decision, where it says that bank, the bank's attempt to influence this referendum amounts to speech. And what it didn't say in the decision is it didn't actually go at all into that decision. It didn't attempt to answer any of those questions. If the First Amendment treats corporate political speech the same way it treats political speech, does that make corporation citizens? And Powell, Justice Lewis Powell, just completely avoided answering that question in his in the majority decision. He said that he basically focused on the speech. He said it doesn't matter whether corporations have First Amendment rights. It doesn't matter if they are citizens. The only thing that matters is that that which emanates from them is political speech or not.
Now, here's what's sort of fascinating. People should also note, obviously, Lewis Powell was the author of the Powell memo, which was a memo written, essentially commissioned by the Chamber of Commerce in response to what they perceived as sort of a war that corporations were losing in the country, specifically following, I think it was Earth Day or in the late 60s, early 70s. And, mm-hmm. and people should also just think, conceptualize this. We in this country, we hear many times that like a foreigner, right? An individual who comes from a different country, comes here, does not have constitutional rights because they're not an American citizen. But this is where you start to see that distinction, right? Because if we were to superimpose this notion of speech is protected, but not the speaker, right? The speaker is irrelevant as long as it suddenly becomes speech. This would implicate all sorts of other issues in terms of what the Constitution, of who gets constitutional rights, or not even, or what gets constitutional rights.
Definitely. I mean, the analogy that everyone uses, that all these constitutional scholars use when they start talking about this morphing of First Amendment rights, is they use the word stretch. They say it's just been stretched to the point where it includes everybody, where it has the possibility of including absolutely everybody, therefore excluding nobody, therefore becoming essentially useless in the court of law. And it's a really interesting time. I mean, if you said this before, that if corporations are able to compile enough case law so that their speech, whether or not it's economic or political, is protected at the same standard that your and my free speech rights are, then it will essentially, the government will not be able to regulate them. any sort of regulation will fall into the category or could be conceived as speech. Anything a corporation does could theoretically be considered speech. And that includes, in sort of our information economy now, that includes digital exchanges of digital information. And we've already seen a lot. IMS Sorrell, I think it was from 2010, saying basically that same thing, that you can't restrict a company from getting digital information that they intend to use in the future, perhaps for advertising and marketing. So it's just this, it's kind of this really interesting, really like fuzzy world right now of what amounts to speech and who can be a speaker under that situation. And if it goes the way the corporations want it to, then there will be no limits. It will be, everything will be speech.
I want to touch on, you make, I think there was three points I think you made in terms of why addressing sort of the free speech purists in this arena who would not have a problem, let's say, with like a Citizens United or whatnot. But before we get there, let me just ask you this. In the context of your reporting, I mean, do you have a sense that the agenda behind these cases is about corporate speech and being able to spend money, or is it your sense that they know where they're going with this in terms of broader regulation?
They know where they're going. I think if you talk to these corporate lawyers, I think they drank the Kool-Aid. I think they believe what they're saying. And it's interesting because you have these archetypal liberals, like Lawrence Tribe and Dellinger, and you have these guys who sort of made their name, and Floyd Abrams made their name defending the First Amendment back in the 60s and 70s when it was used to protect anarchists and dissidents, and the New York Times and the Pentagon paper case. And you have them also defending corporations now, because they say their point is basically what we've been saying. It doesn't matter who's doing the speaking. It only matters what the speech is. And they've drank the Kool-Aid too. they honestly believe, and I respect the hell out of these guys, and they honestly believe that this is correct. On the part of the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and things like that, I don't think that you could plausibly say that they don't know exactly where this is going.
Right.
Challenging the country of origin labeling rule based on First Amendment grounds, they know exactly where that's going to go.
All right. So let's take these arguments. I mean, you write that the First Amendment purists, I mean, and you're talking about those guys like a guy like Tribe. Mm-hmm. They argue if we limit the definition of speech or wade into the muck deciding who gets to be a speaker under the law and who does not, then we position ourselves on a slippery slope. In other words, if you start to say that corporations can't have free speech, then it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to saying, you know, vegans can't have free speech.
Right, exactly. And that's really the specter, the sort of terrifying idea that they hold up. They say, you know, as soon as you start limiting speech, then you can say, anarchists can't speak, or Muslims can't speak, or vegans, or whoever you want to say, you know, they don't get the same rights as speaker. And as I say in the piece, I think that's just, it's sort of, seems to me like just sort of blatant fear mongering. You can draw the line and you can say any single human being in America has total free speech rights, absolutely no holds barred. But you draw the line at human beings. It just doesn't apply to corporate entities.
And you know, I mean, this is the other thing that I'm raised before we get to your second point about what a purist would say as well, is that has there ever been an attempt to simply say, look, they are not capable of political speech because they are commercial entities? Like they can never, because they are licensed as a commercial entity to do commerce, that everything they do is commerce. in the context of a corporation. Like, they're, even when they engage in politics, it is commerce. It is from money that was derived from their I guess their status as a commercial, exclusively a commercial being. Is that principle been argued at any given point?
Well, yeah. I mean, of course it's been argued. And interestingly, it's been argued sort of originally by Rehnquist and Bork and these sort of traditional conservative justices. They're the ones that when these decisions on commercial speech first started coming down in 1975 and 76 and 78, saying they're the ones who raised the red flag and said, oh no, this is not going in the right direction. Bork said that the protection of the First Amendment must be cut off when it reaches the outer limits of political speech. And that's a direct quote. He was not into this idea of commercial speech at all. And then Rehnquist says the same thing. He says the logical consequences of the court's decision in this case, referring to Virginia Pharmacy, a decision which elevates commercial intercourse to the same place as had been previously reserved for the free marketplace of ideas, are far-reaching indeed. Oh. But Bork and Rehnquist, these guys were saying exactly what you're saying. They're saying a commercial entity exists because our laws allow it to exist in order to perform a commercial function. That is completely different than you and me who exist despite the fact, we don't exist because our laws allow us to exist. And this gets to the second point that we were talking about before, that it's, the First Amendment purists will say, you can't restrict speech to any speaker because, you know, that creates this slippery slope. And then if you give the argument that I just gave, which is, okay, fine, cut it off at human beings and non-human beings, they'll say, well, what about when human beings get together into a group? And again, they make that seem like it's this very scary thing, but it's not. Each human being inside that group still retains all of his or her rights. You know, you can be a CEO of a Fortune 500 company and you can still go out into the park and scream and yell about whatever political idea you want. You don't give up your rights by being a part of a corporation. And the corporate entity itself is already treated differently under our laws. They're taxed differently. They have different privileges. They have different, they can't plead the fifth. A corporate entity can't plead the fifth. A human can, and it's they
have limited liability. There's a whole set of, well, once you incorporate, you're a different being, essentially.
Exactly, and you're treated differently legally. I mean, limited liability is a great example. It's if you mess up, you know, your books as a corporation, you are treated differently legally than if you mess up your books as a human being. It's just the idea that you can't treat human beings differently than you treat corporations is just a completely silly notion.
And so under your what you're proposing there, what happens to something, let's say, like a union, or what happens to, let's say, an advocacy group?
Well, what do you mean, what happens to them?
In terms of their speech. I mean, is their speech then limited as well?
Well, they need to, each individual advocate is not limited in any way. You know, if you join Planned Parenthood and the mere fact that you are a human being who stands under this umbrella of Planned Parenthood doesn't mean that your rights are in any way abridged. Your free speech rights are totally unabridgeable. They're absolute. But the free speech rights of the advocacy group, of the organization, of the union, of the corporation, all those things are the same. All those things are artificial organizations of human beings. They can be, though, that speech can be treated differently.
Right. And so that speech as well, like a corporation, would be subject to a government interest.
Exactly. Yeah. And they can fight for those interests in the same way you know, on the ground in state houses and local court, in local, elections, they can fight for those rights in the same way that any other entity does. They just can't use this constitutional right intended for humans.
And of course, I mean, let's go to just the third point here. And that's, which is I've heard raised, on several occasions. What do you do about, MSNBC? Because they're owned by, GE and Comcast and, you know, at one point they were owned totally, or at least the majority by GE. This is a big arms manufacturer. I mean, what do you do in that instance? Do you say that, Chris Hayes can't go out and advocate for, it doesn't have the same right to go out and advocate for liberal policies?
Well, so this is also one of these First Amendment purist scare tactics, is they say, well, as you limit the speech of corporations, then you're destroying freedom of press in this country. But that just doesn't make sense, because in the First Amendment, press is specifically listed as worthy of the First Amendment's protection. It actually, the founding fathers actually called out press and said, you know, this law applies to all humans and press. So they say, you know, the idea of limiting this law to carefully define and afford protections to editorial activities to Chris Hayes, then that it's written into the law itself. That doesn't mean that you have to afford the rights and privileges of GE's speech. That's not an editorial activity. It does get interesting. I mean, these are not black and white issues. These do require debate. And I don't mean to be oversimplifying it here. You do have to say, I mean, there's a really interesting case involving Standard & Poor's that's been going on for more than a decade. They say that their ratings are speech. They call themselves that's an editorial activity. They say, you know, each of those ratings is the world's smallest editorial or whatever the phrase is. And the courts have bought that. They've said that Standard & Poor's ratings fall under the category of editorial activity. So of course there's gray areas there. Of course that needs to be litigated. But the idea that you can't restrict corporations' free speech without killing freedom of press is just, it's just sort of fear mongering and using one of these slippery slope theories. It's insane.
Well, there you go. You don't my credit score also just a little tiny editorial that. All right. Well, Haley Sweetland Edwards, the piece is The Corporate Free Speech Racket. We've got a link to it. Really appreciate your pointing this out. I mean, it's a fascinating story of the evolution of the First Amendment. And it also makes, I think, it brings a broader understanding when we start to see why all these corporations sort of line up to fund something like Hobby Lobby. It's not just because they know there may be some electoral advantage to having this narrative of religious oppression. It's because there's a larger agenda at work here. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and then come back. And apparently, Clive and Bundy did not just say this. Clive and Bundy, apparently, when he's on the record for saying this stuff about how black people seemed so much happier during slavery, according to a guy who was born in the 1940s, apparently he also did it for the video camera. So I guess we got some sound. We will play that when we come back. Also, a couple other stories. Tomorrow on the program, I believe we will have Cliff Schechter and also an old friend of mine, Matt Walsh, who plays that guy on Veep. What guy does he play?
He plays
the bald guy.
Okay, let's leave it at that.
I don't even remember his name. on there. But
Mike.
Mike. He'll be on the program tomorrow calling in to tell us about Veep. All right, folks. We're going to take a break. This show cannot function without your support, without its member support. And so I want to thank our members for keeping this show alive. And I want to ask those people who enjoy the program but have not become members, become a member. By all means, it's pennies a day, and it makes this show possible, and it'll make it possible for us. I mean, at one point, I'm going to get sick of coming into this little sweat box, and we want a slightly bigger sweat box, maybe. And maybe an upgrade. Cameras. Better camera situation. Young Turks got $4 million. Was it four or five?
Four.
They got an investment of $4 million from Buddy Romer. Didn't I say we should have him on at one point?
I don't think that's how he determined
I'm
who
sure.
to...
We do not have a venture capital money coming in. We don't.
$4 million to the first new media organization who has me on their show.
If you are interested in investing $4 million in this program, please email us. We'll have you on at least twice next year. Short of that, you can support this program with 33 cents a day. And as a bonus, we give you an extra 50 minutes a day. So become a member today at majority.fm. Get the app at Majority App. Support this program by going to majorityreportkickback.com. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through that link. Click that link, bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon crap through there. We get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. The number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can IM me. We'll be right back after this.